Welcome to the Small Caps Podcast, where we discuss news and information related to ASX-listed companies and financial markets, keeping investors informed. Note that the content in this podcast is not financial or investment advice, and be sure to head over to smallcaps.com.au to get the latest market news. Now, without further delay, here's today's podcast.
Today, I am delighted to speak to one of the busiest people that I know, given everything that's going on. His name is Martin North. He is the principal of Digital Finance Analytics, who covers all things property and finance in a distinctly Australian way. Martin North, welcome to the program. Nice to see you.
Hi, Kerry. Nice to see you. And nice that you quote my introduction. That's very good. Thank you. You've done your homework.
Look, Martin, we're living in pretty crazy times at the moment. We all know that. You know, I noticed today that Queensland have shut their borders again. COVID is causing dramatic changes. Some people are only focusing on the small picture. What I'm looking at today, I've listened to you in the past talking about the property market, and we all know that Australia is fixated on property. And one of the things I'm always talking about is we're here to educate people how to protect and grow their wealth. And I agree with you that I think some people's heads are in the sand. And I'd love to hear your views where you see, because things have changed and they're constantly changing. Love to hear your views on what are people not seeing at the moment in terms of property and finance in general, Martin?
Well, I think a good place to start, and I do agree that many people are myopic on property and indeed on finance more generally. People need to understand that what's happened in the last 20 to 25 years in the finance and property sector is unusual, I would say almost unique. If you take a 150-year view of property prices in Australia, they've basically gone sideways for a long time. They went up after the war, sideways, and then up, massively up in the last 20 years. Now, people need to understand that 20-year sort of to the moon, as it were created by a series of one-off events which are unlikely to be repeated. And I'll just quickly go through them. The first is there was massive deregulation of the financial sector in Australia and indeed around the world. There was a lowering of lending standards so that people could actually borrow more and more. Migration was turned up to the max. And we had an RBA policy post the global financial crisis that said, well, we know mining is coming off the boil. We need another plan. And plan B was to get more people to borrow more to be able to buy property, to create wealth, to buy more property. And so that positive reinforcing feedback loop drove prices really, really high, particularly in the eastern states, to the point where we've got the highest debt now relative to income pretty much as anywhere around the world, number two or number one, depending on how precisely you calculate it. And we have a lot of people who are highly leveraged into property, but the trend line of property prices, in fact, if you look carefully, it was sort of very strong up from 2000 to 2008, sideways, up again, flat and falling, right? But people have got this fixation that property doubles every 7 years, right? And every time I survey people, but half of them still believe that. So let's debunk the myth, right? Yeah. That property always goes up. It can go up, sure, but it can also go sideways. It can go down. And just to give you an example, in Perth, the peak in prices in Perth were 2012. Prices since then have gone down. And in fact, they're 21 or 22% below their peak, right? Wow. And they're still falling, right? And so people need to understand that prices don't always go up. Then you need to go granular, because what actually, when you start looking at property, you realize that even in those boom times, not all properties in all locations, in all types, went up, right? And we're seeing a massive divergence. So yeah, sure, there are some sectors where in fact property is still relatively strong and it probably will stay so because there's a limited supply and a lot of demand. You know, houses close into the center of town, for example, generally hold their value better because there's just not enough of them and people want to live close in. But if you look at high-rise apartments, and you know, the masses masses of construction that have been going on recently. We've got so many apartments that we don't know what to do with them. We've got 1.2 million spare properties in Australia. A lot of those are apartments. And so apartment prices are going the other way. And particularly if they are not in prime locations, and particularly if there are thousands and thousands of thousands all the same, and the secondary market where people are trying to sell is competing with the construction of yet more new property, and so prices fall. So the point to make is that once you start looking at property in more detail and really getting granular, don't rely on those property indices. They're telling you nothing at all. They just are useless, right? You've got to go granular. You've got to actually look at individual locations, individual types of property, and then you start realizing the truth that property is a two-way bet, not a one-way bet.
Oh.
Property can go up, but property can and often does go down. And therefore, when you make your decisions about property, and particularly property investing, which I think is very, very risky at the moment, we can unpack that in a bit more in a bit later, right? Property investing in particular is highly risky at the moment, because as well as that mega trend that I've spoken about, we've now got some immediate issues with regard to COVID. COVID basically is a catalyst that's created a massive disruption in the economy. Unemployment, which was sitting at 5.2 or 5.3% before COVID hit, is likely to be at 10% by the end of the year, according to the Reserve Bank's latest data. And
even more.
Well, I was going to say that's a very conservative number because it doesn't include underemployment, and it's probably not fully reflecting everything that's going on at the moment with regards to what the virus is doing. That level of unemployment triggers mortgage defaults like you wouldn't believe. And we're already seeing early signs of that. And what that means is that we're going to have a further disruption of demand supply in terms of property. Migration, of course, has been turned off because of COVID. So overseas demand has gone. Overseas buyers, anyway, we're exiting for all sorts of reasons, not least because China's ratcheted back the ability for Chinese people to buy externally. And so we've got this massive crunch coming. So as well as that mega trend that prices don't always go up, we've now got this new environment, and it's a really, I think, uncomfortable environment. And I'm not sure that people yet have got their heads around the full implications for investing generally and for property in particular.
Martin, you just said there is a crunch coming. It seems to me there's a lot of government stimulus at the moment, which almost masks what's going on. When you say that there is a crunch coming, are you thinking in the near term or are you thinking 2021 or beyond? Because right now, what I'm reading is, you know, and I know a lot of this is not quite the truth, is property is going up, places being sold over reserve, and the media narrative is almost saying to people, get in now before it's too late. And I only read this morning, this is the perfect time for first home buyers to get in. And you know what? That to me is great danger, because it's encouraging people to over leverage at a time when there is danger.
Well, there's a few points to unpack there. The first is you need to understand that a lot of the media is directly connected to the real estate sector. In fact, quite a lot of the real estate portals are owned by the media, right? First point. Second point is all of the incentives to try and get people to buy is to support the construction sector, because the construction sector creates well over a million jobs across Australia. And a lot of those are actually, you know, looking quite wobbly at the moment. So governments want to try and use, if I can use this expression, first-time buyers as cannon fodder.
Wow.
To keep the property market up, right? But there is absolutely no guarantee that if you buy a property now, it's going to appreciate in value. You could well lose your deposit over the medium term. And all of this spruiking from the mainstream media and from a small number now of property experts are not taking the real situation into account. In fact, many of the property observers who a month or two ago were talking about prices will rise are now saying 10% drop, 15% drop, 20% drop. And I won't name any of them, but there was one or two very, very bullish property spruikers who've now turned turtle and said, well, you know, the Melbourne situation in particular is going to actually make it very difficult. Let's be clear. This is not a time to pile into property, right? Even if you're a first-time buyer, be really, really, really careful. Understand why the mainstream media's spinning the yarn, why the government is encouraging first-time buyers, you know, with that 95% grant and everything like that. And remember, the global financial crisis taught us in the US that the property cycle takes 3 to 4 years to work through after a crisis. So you asked me, is this a short-term or long-term thing? There are short-term hiatuses at the moment running all over the place, but the property cycle is probably down for a 5 to 7 year down cycle at the moment, unless we, one, can nail the virus immediately, and I think that's unlikely. I think the vaccine situation is much more knife-edged than many people think. Secondly, we have to be able to open up our borders to be able to actually bring migrants back into Australia, because without that, the population growth is just, you know, half of what it was or worse, and that means that the demand is not there. Thirdly, because property prices are falling and because rents are falling because there's so much surplus property, most property investors, more than half of property investors, are actually losing money day in, day out at the moment. That's why around 12% of property investors, according to my surveys, are now looking to sell. And what we are seeing is a lot of people holding their breath, hoping that their incomes come back so that they can continue to make their mortgage repayments. But hope is not necessarily a strategy. We've got the banks who've been allowed to offer interest and principal repayment holidays for 6 months. That ends effectively in September. Then they have a 4-month second window from APRA, during which time the banks have to speak to individual borrowers about their financial situation and whether it's likely that they're actually going to be able to start making their repayments again. And data came out yesterday from APRA that showed only a very small proportion of people are starting to make those repayments currently. So the chances are we've got a lot of people who have a permanently changed income scenario, and that means they're going to find it very, very difficult to make those repayments. And just to underscore that, I measure something called mortgage stress, which is a cash flow-based analysis of households, money coming in, money going out, how much money is coming in, how much money is going out. If, in fact, more money is going out and coming in on an ongoing basis, people have a problem. And that number at the end of July was 40.2% of all mortgaged households. That's as high as it's ever been. That's more than 1.5 million households in financial stress with regard to their mortgages at the moment. Now, some of those will cure, probably. But the point you made was that, of course, this is a temporary situation because the incentives that are out there at the moment are going to be disappearing over the next few months. JobKeeper, JobSeeker, all those things. And, you know, I'm sure the government will have to do more to sort of support the economy. But the level of support we got in the last quarter was astronomical relative to what's ahead. So you've got to assume that the economy is going to grumble along for a long, long time. And more mortgage holders, both investors and owner-occupiers, are going to be struggling. So that's why I think this is not just an immediate short-term, you know, V-shaped recovery and everything's fine. You've got to be thinking 3 to 5 years. And what I say to people is, look, if you want to buy a property for somewhere to live for the next 5 to 10 years, and you're happy to risk your capital in that process, and you're buying it because it's actually, you know, shelter, you know, a cave and protection for your family, then fine, go ahead. But if you're buying property on the expectation that it's going to double every 7 years like it did earlier on, some people think, as I explained earlier, or if you're buying it for investment purposes only, don't. Because the world just changed, and the world changed not just temporarily, but I think this is quite a significant disruptive change, which will take many years to come out at the end of. And I don't think we're ever going to see the same run-up as we saw.
That was quite, I think the one thing that stood out to me when you were just speaking was 40.2% of all mortgage holders are in stress. Yep. And as you said just before that, you know, they're all having these sort of holidays from their mortgages at the moment. So likely scenario is come January, you know, because we've got the September and then we've got the 4 months. So it's really 2021 is crunch time.
Yeah, I think 2021, 2022. 2021 will be the critical thing. I wouldn't be surprised if APRA gives the banks more wriggle room. And I wouldn't be surprised if we end up with a Reserve Bank buying distressed properties off the banks to keep the banks afloat. Because the trouble is we've now got another issue, and that is that 65% of lending from the banks is for property.
Yeah.
Now, if property prices go down, not only do you have individual pain in households, but you have massive structural issues with regard to financial stability. And both the Reserve Bank and APRA are very worried about financial stability. And they keep talking up the capital strength of the banks. But here's an interesting little observation. You know that the Reserve Bank has been providing very cheap funding to the banks to support them in recent times, 60 basis points below where it was, right?
No.
APRA's now said that the banks will be allowed to pay dividends, half of the income they've created, to their shareholders. So what's actually happening, if you stand back and think about it, is cheap money raised by the Reserve Bank, thrown across to the banks, who then can pay dividends. That's actually the true story of the way that the financial system is being propped up at the moment. And that's because both the government, Reserve Bank, and APRA are concerned about the financial stability of the system here. And they keep saying everything's absolutely fine. But if you look below the covers, there are some warning signs there. They're running down their capital buffers. Their profitability is under pressure. They're competing very hard for new mortgages, particularly low-risk mortgages, and particularly refinancing. Refinancing is 40% higher than it was previously. But you've got to stand back and just think about this whole thing more structurally and say, what does this tell us about our economy? Because, look, we've been a house and holes economy in Australia. In other words, we've been digging up and selling overseas the resource sector, and we've been relying on this massive housing bubble, which has actually created artificial wealth so that people may feel a little bit more wealthy, but actually all it's done is it's basically just devalued the value of money, frankly. And the other point I'd make is that in this environment, when effectively a lot of that money that's being printed by central banks around the world has flowed into the financial system, what's happened is that corporates have bought back their own shares, so prices have gone up. A lot of that money's flowed then into the financial system. So effectively, the money printing, if I can put that in inverted commas, has supported stocks, you know, which is one reason why the stock markets are very high. Supported house prices, as we've explained. But a lot of this is illusory, right? And so therefore, the investment risks, whatever asset classes you look at, are actually very, very high at the moment. And my own perspective is that there is no such thing as a risk-free investment, be it property, be it shares, or be it other asset classes too, particularly now.
But I'd like to ask this, Martin. You know, I look at it and I say, you know, if you and I did it, which is what I call the magic money machine, which just keeps printing this currency, because it's not money, it's currency, which is credit. And if they keep using the magic money machine, you mentioned the stock markets going up, wouldn't then property prices, by way of, excuse the pun, default, go up as well? In other words, all that liquidity has to go somewhere. And wouldn't it be going into real assets? So then, you know, if the money printing machine, the magic money printing machine, keeps on going, why then would it not flow on into what I call hard assets, real assets, and allow the property market prices, you know, the value, your purchasing power is going down, but the numbers are going up? So it's kind of, it's a little bit like black magic.
Well, it is absolutely, it's a magic pudding, and the magic pudding has worked quite well for the last 20 years, right? But as I said, it's all illusory. It's not real wealth, right? And people are now beginning to realize, you know, if I take property as an example, if you look at recent property transactions, a lot of them are actually selling at lower levels than they did 2 or 3 years ago, right? And that's an emerging trend. So people are losing money if they bought relatively recently. Now, if you bought 20 years ago, sure, you're sitting on significant equity. But now a lot of people are saying, well, maybe I should get out of property and release that equity and then put it into something else, right? And there is obviously an argument that says, well, if banks go on printing and printing and printing, all that capital currency that's created has got to go somewhere. Where's it going to go? Is it going to go into property? Well, it might. But then you've got to say, well, who's going to be buying the property, right? Because in the moment, all the trends are pointing property prices down, not up, right? All of the issues with regards to defaults, they're going up, not down. We've got an oversupply of property at the moment. We've got an undersupply of people who want to buy it. So if you stand back and think about it economically in a supply and demand perspective, then essentially that tells me that it's unlikely in the short term, and I mean short term, over the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see prices rising. In the longer term, probably, possibly. And interestingly, I also think that different asset types, so I'm looking at quite a lot of interest at the moment out there in land and, you know, more rural properties rather than in towns and particularly the high-rise apartment markets. And I said earlier on, you've got to break it out, right? There will be areas where you can probably see longer term growth if you take a very long term view, but it's not going to be a straightforward. And I think that the question we should be standing back and asking ourselves is how much more money printing will they be able to do before they damage the currency? Because there is a consequence of this debasement of the currency that you mentioned, right? And that is that essentially the currency becomes less and less attractive potentially. And if international investors who basically have been buying into Australia for a long time start saying, well, I'm not sure whether this is actually what we want to do anymore, suddenly we could see a very significant impact on the currency. Now, there is an argument saying we need a lower currency because that would help with inflation. And it would also help potentially with managing the trade balance that we have. The currency at 70 something is very high relative to where I think it probably should be. So there are a lot of big open questions. All I'm saying, I think, to people is be really cautious and careful and don't make big assumptions about the way that these economic factors are going to play out, because this is a new experiment. We've never had so much money printing around the world. You know, the Fed in the US has printed 5.5 trillion over recent times. 85% of that's gone directly back into the financial markets. Yeah. And a lot of that has just gone into corporates issuing bonds that they then buy back their shares to support the share price. That is a Ponzi scheme, right? It is one of the biggest that we've ever seen. And I have to say that property is another Ponzi scheme, and that's the problem. So as soon as the magic money machine stops, as soon as the music stops and people actually stand back and think, oh, hang on a moment, it's not quite what I thought it was, then the risk is that you then start to see significant corrections. And remember that prices dropped 40% in the US, you know, similar in the UK past and the global financial crisis. And let me make this point. If you take long-term trend averages relative to income and GDP, right, our house prices on average in Australia are 40% overvalued relative to those long-term trends. And the longer you actually are above long-term trend, the bigger the fall that you need to get back to long-term trend. And I still note that in Sydney and Melbourne, people are being offered mortgages at eight times income, right? That is massive relative to what I think a more normal four times or three and a half to four times would be if you actually came back. So we're already in a situation where prices for property way over where it should be. The longer we leave it, the more it's going to come back and the harder the fall. And so I've got a view that says, while in theory the magic money machine can go on supporting, in practice, I'm not convinced that property is going to actually display the sorts of trends that many people are suggesting.
That's a very good overview, Martin. It's kind of an outlook where you go, listen, ladies and gentlemen, what we're talking about here is how to protect your wealth.
Yep.
You know, don't go out rushing out there thinking that, you know, all this magic money printing, you'll be fine. And if a bank wants to, or a lender wants to loan you eight times, as Martin just said, don't over leverage yourself. Not in this particular time, because it is topsy-turvy and we have never experienced anything like this, I don't think, in history. Martin, I want to ask you about deflation and inflation. You do a lot of analysis on finance. You do a lot of analysis on markets. You know, I've said this before, that I think that where we're sitting right now, you know, the velocity of money isn't there. People are staying home. People are not spending. So I think short term we might have some deflationary pressure, but longer term, and I'd love to hear your views on this, longer term, I think we're going to see massive inflation just on the basis of what's going on today, but it won't play out for another 12 months to 2 years. I'd love to hear your views.
Well, there's a couple of observations. First is, if you look at the money supply, the broad money measure, it was up by more than 10%. And that's because of all the government stimulus, or, you know, this pulling superannuation out, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of that money is not going anywhere at the moment. So that's an interesting observation. And the retail numbers were relatively benign when they came out yesterday. So we're in a situation where at the moment there is money sloshing around the system, but the velocity of your money isn't actually moving faster. It's actually slowing. And that sluggishness could actually lead to effectively prices going, you know, into negative territory. And there is a big, big question here about, is the strategic future deflationary or inflationary? And there are massive differences of opinion out there, right? Mm. So there are some people saying all of this money that's being printed, you know, and we discussed that earlier on, is going to basically stoke asset prices. So we're going to see massive inflation, and inflation is going to be a real killer. And therefore, we need to protect. And therefore, you know, physical assets like silver and gold are the way to go, right? So that's one end of the spectrum. And there are people talking up the gold price, you know, 5,000, you know, 6,000 US, whatever, right? And saying that's the future, right? There are other people who are saying, hang on a moment. You've got to understand where all that liquidity is actually going, right? The liquidity that's being printed by the central banks is not going into the real economy. So it may not actually create the inflationary pressures that people are thinking at the moment. And if that's the case, then the future is more like Japan. And Japan has had a 20-year deflationary cycle. So if you look at property prices in Japan, they're a lot lower than they were. If you look at standards of living in Japan, they've actually not improved. And so you've got this big dilemma. Which are the way? Because frankly, if it's deflationary, then you don't really want to be in hard assets like gold and silver. You want to actually, you know, keep liquid until later, and then make strategies later. That's the dilemma we face. I cannot read which of these two futures is the most likely, but I don't believe that this inflationary view that is probably predominating is necessarily a very sophisticated view. And there's a reason for that, that if you think back to the 70s and the 80s, and I'm old enough to remember the old cycle, I've been through four crash cycles.
Be careful, Martin, so have I.
We won't tell anybody. But look, the point is that they were actually, when inflation was running hot and they had to try and pull it back. But the situation is different, I think, now. And I worry that we could actually end up in a Japanese scenario where, in fact, it's long-term deflation, because there's no evidence yet that all this money printing has actually solved anything at all. It's just created more of a problem. They're probably going to print more, but maybe there's a disconnection between what central banks think they're doing and what they're actually doing, for the reasons that I've explained earlier on. So I tend to veer slightly towards the deflationary, uncertain view, rather than, sure, it's going to be very, very inflationary, and therefore you should protect your assets in that mode. Now, there'll be other people who fundamentally disagree with me, and I accept that. I don't have all the answers. All I'm saying is, we need to be looking for the early leading indicators to understand whether it's going to be inflationary or deflationary. And it's tricky, because it might be we get a bit of inflation and then deflation, or we might get deflation and then inflation, right? And it's hard to read. What I personally think, it's quite good to be relatively flexible in your investment strategy, maintain flexibility and frankly, maintain some liquidity. And I just say to people, look, you know, those who are gold bugs, you might well be right. The prices could go very high for a time and then come back down. But of course, you can't eat gold, right? You've actually got to be able to convert it, right? So in fact, there's always a question about holding physical assets, about how secure they are and what price it will be when you want to turn it into something that you can spend at the shops. There are other people saying, well, maybe there's a digital future that's going to be completely different than you, and maybe that's where we should be looking for the future. I want to say, I think people need to understand the level of uncertainty that we've got in the economies around the world is probably more extreme than it's ever been. And I personally believe that anybody who claims to know for sure what the next 5 years is going to look like is...
I lost you there.
Don't know whether COVID's going to...
Martin, I've just lost you there. Sorry. Oh, there you're back again.
All right. I don't know. I'll just say the last bit again. So yeah. here's my point. There are many people who think they know for sure what the next 5 years is going to look like. I personally think there are too many variables, too many uncertainties. We don't know whether COVID is going to be, still around in 5 years' time. We don't know whether, in fact, the central bank printing is going to be successful or not. We don't know whether the US-China situation is going to get worse or better. Almost wherever you look, you've got a whole bunch of different interconnected issues. And therefore, because of the fact there's so much uncertainty, my own belief is you need to be thinking through different scenarios. What would happen if this scenario? What would happen in that scenario, right? Inflation, deflation. And then you've got to make some trade-off decisions about which way you want to go and how much protection you want to build in, rather than sort of nailing your colors to the mast and say, I'm sure it's going to be inflationary and therefore I'm sure that gold and silver are the right ones. You might be right, but you could be wrong. And that's what I sometimes say to people is ask yourself the other question. What if I'm wrong? What would that mean? And frankly, my own strategy has been to maintain maximum flexibility and agility until such time as things get a little clearer. And hopefully they will in a, you know, some months or some years' time. But we are in a very, very uncertain time at the moment.
Yeah, it's a time. And in fact, what I say to a lot of people, I do a Facebook Live every day at 2:30 where I just have a little bit of commentary about what's going on. But what I always say is, you know, be resourceful, get educated, stop watching Netflix. But the other thing I say, and you all know this, don't you? Hedge and diversify, hedge and diversify. Yeah. And as Martin just said, don't put all your eggs in one basket, because it could. We're in unprecedented times. Even Martin has alluded to the fact that none of us actually know what's going to happen. We're all sitting here thinking, how do we protect, how do we even just protect our wealth, much less grow our wealth? And Martin, I'd like to just quickly go over, you mentioned the Aussie dollar, the currency, and how it was quite strong at just over 70 cents, which is where it's sitting at the moment. What are your views on the Aussie dollar? And do you think that it is going to go stronger? Or do you think we're going to have a bit of a pullback? And what are the catalysts that are going to drive the Australian dollar?
Well, I think you've got to understand the Aussie dollar more to do with what's happening to the US dollar, right? It tends to be a little bit of a counterplay. You know, we were sitting well below, 60 earlier on, and that would have, of course, helped inflation and potentially helped our terms of trade. At 70, it's quite extended. I think there's a chance that it will go higher because I think the US dollar is probably going to go weaker ahead. I mean, we've got the US election, of course, in the next 2 or 3 months. There's a lot of uncertainty in the US. We don't know whether they will continue to provide stimulus to the economy there and, you know, fiscal stimulus rather than the Fed. The Fed's pretty much said rates are going to stay very low for a long time. We're not even thinking about talking about rates rising, which is quite a nice way to put it, right? So they're stuck in that very low rate environment. So we know that the interest rates will be low. A number of people I speak to say the way to understand this is to look at what bonds are doing, because bonds are looking as though they could be actually about to break out. And if that's true, then we could see a significant readjustment of Aussie versus US dollar, and in our favor in the short term. In other words, the rate will go higher. But as I say, there are consequences of a high exchange rate, and the Reserve Bank won't want it because it will make their job even harder. Postscript, should they even be trying to target an inflation rate of 2 to 3%? I mean, that for me is one of the big policy questions that nobody wants to answer. Question two is, has the Reserve Bank done a good job over the last 10 years or not? No, they haven't. They've stuffed us up, I think, frankly, and they've made some major policy mistakes. They have been as inaccurate as the Treasury in terms of their forecasts. So we actually have no accountability in Australia for the poor policy settings that we've had for at least a decade. But my own view is the US dollar is probably going to weaken, therefore the Aussie dollar will probably go stronger first. The question is next year, the year after, that goes back to what our economy is going to look like. We're not investing in new things. We're not investing in innovation here in Australia. We're not creating new businesses on the ground, which is what we should be doing. What we're doing is going to the old playbook, the old Reagan playbook, the old Thatcher playbook, according to Frydenberg. And if that's true, then in the medium term, I would expect the dollar to come back quite considerably.
I'm going to finalize with one last question for you, Martin, and then we'll talk a little bit about DFA. your views on gold? Because I know, see, I'm fairly bullish on gold. Everybody knows I call myself a gold nerd because I look at it as a long-term protection of against currency debasement, which is happening right now with the magic money machine. Would you advise people to look at gold as an investment, or are you just not there?
Well, there's three things. You've got to understand what drives the price of gold, mm-hmm. right? So we know that there's a physical price of gold, and we also know that there are derivatives of all sorts and flavors and types that actually are also connected and driving gold to an extent. And if you look at the ratio, I mean, I was talking to somebody the other day who's a silver bug, and he's saying there are 500 times the ratio of derivatives to underlying silver. 500 times.
Wow. Right?
So that tells you that there is massive speculation in the metals markets, and people are taking positions and then trading out those positions to make money or lose money, depending on exactly how the price goes. So people are betting on the price and on price movements, right? So people need to understand that gold and silver are not clean markets. They're not different from currency markets or interest rate markets or stock markets. They have the same characteristics. They have the same over leverage. They have the same massive liquidity trading issues there. So that's the first point. So don't think necessarily that gold is somehow magically different, right? What it does have, of course, is some intrinsic value. And over time, if the currency gets devalued, then that value can be stronger, and that can be positive. And I've always said that I regard gold as something you should probably have in your portfolio. Yeah. So my point about gold is that there is this physical market, and then you've got all of these derivatives, right? Multiple multiplications. Many of the large institutions internationally, the major banks, are actually very, very heavy traders in the derivatives markets of those commodities. And yep. they do influence. Now, what we're seeing at the moment is an interesting convergence whereby the physical markets, people are wanting to actually close out those contracts to the physical market. And that's one of the reasons why the prices are rising. Yep. The question is that going to be sustainable or not? Or do we get to the point where that runs out of smoke? And there are people saying that within the next 3 months, we will know. It could be we see a considerable rise. At that point, my own view is that might be the point to sell gold if you've been holding it for some time, because you've got a significant run-up and it's probably now reached a record. By the way, if you look at it in inflation-adjusted terms, it's still below where it was previously. So that's the other point to make. A longer term, it goes to why are you holding gold? If you're holding gold as a bit of a safe and secure hedge for the future, then maybe. But I also think there is a significant risk in a deflationary world, which is the one that I'm seeing, that gold actually loses attraction and loses value. And so whilst I'm seeing a bit of a run-up now, I think later it could go down again. So I think people need to be cautious and careful about assuming that gold will magically always go up, right? And that this magic money machine means that, you know, gold is the safe and secure investment forever. You need to watch it carefully, and you need to make some calls, I think, as to whether it's time to go up, down, or in or out. So I'm not as bearish of gold as many people accuse me of. And I said earlier on, I don't know whether the future is going to be inflationary or deflationary. What I do know is that having diverse assets makes a lot of sense from an investing point of view, particularly now because there are so many uncertainties. I've tended to go more to the stock markets rather than gold over time, simply because I'm more concerned about the manipulation in the gold sector and the fact that a lot of people don't see it. I've done a lot of work in derivatives over the years, and I see it, and I see all of the positioning that people take. But what I come back to is none of those asset classes are risk-free. They all have risks attached to them. You can say Bitcoin is precisely the same. There's all a degree of speculation everywhere. So diversification, no setting and forgetting, rather being quite active in terms of managing and watching for those early signs of changes of trajectory and then responding is probably the right way to go at the moment.
I quite like that, a very sound advice. And it goes to what I say to people, that although I do believe that gold is money, gold and silver are money, and I do believe it does protect. I've been saying for probably 10 years now that for me, exposure to gold and silver has been important. And for me, it is as a commodity, it's working for me. But, you know, I've done hedging and diversifying, you know, into other sectors as well. Martin, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. But how can people find you and your analysis? And I know you do a lot of blogging and You've got a YouTube channel. So just tell our listeners how they can find, how to tune into your future commentary.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for that. So there's a YouTube channel called Walk the World. And on that channel, I'm doing daily shows on finance and property and a bit of philosophy and all those things. I also have a blog at digitalfinanceanalytics.com. We survey households and businesses, and that information feeds all our modeling. And I'm also on Twitter at DFA Analyst. So very active in social media, very active in analysis. And look, I'm all about informing, educating, helping people to understand more about what's going on, not trying to give people a nice pat answer and say, do this or do that, but to enable and equip people to make very important decisions in an uncertain time. And therefore, sharing my thoughts and ideas and indeed my analysis is what I do.
Well, and that's why it's been such a pleasure to have you on today, because like you, I'm trying to wake people up to not just be asleep at the wheel and then wake up and say, what the heck happened? So, you know, get educated, be resourceful. And as I always say to you, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to make sure that you stop watching Netflix and start listening to people like Martin North. Any last comments?
Well, I was just going to say precisely that I'm worried about the fact that the majority of people in Australia don't care a fig about all this stuff, right? They're down at the beach or they're watching Netflix. And I remind people of what happened in the days of Rome, where basically they said, let them have bread and circuses and everything will be fine, right? No. It's time to take control of your own financial situation, make your own decisions, get informed, and listen to these sorts of shows and listen to my shows, because you can't rely on other people or the government getting you out of the hole that we're in. It's the decisions that you take now which will actually determine your financial future, not just for the next couple of years, but for the next couple of decades.
Very sound advice, Martin, and I totally, totally agree. Ladies and gentlemen, as we both said now, stop watching Netflix and get educated, because right now you are being told that everything's okay, and as Martin North has just described to you, perhaps it's not, and it's perhaps time that you got educated. We'll see you next time. Thanks for watching.